Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9:02 a.m. Tuesday, March 8th, 2011. Today is in the co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, myself, Stedman. We're going to have two bills up today, both for the first time. Senate Bill 18 will be the first up, duration of the regular legislative session. Senate Bill 19, passenger vessel rental tax. First bill up today will be Senate Bill 18 by Senator Stevens regarding the duration of the regular legislative session. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to hear from the sponsor, to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further review. If Senator Stevens could come forward. And before he could introduce himself for the record and who he represents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gary Stevens, Kodiak, Senate District R.
And before you get going, Senator Stevens, I'd just like to note for the record that you are the Senate President, and the chairman here has new bifocals, so we could watch your numerics a little closer, and they're in crystal clear view now. So, Senator Stevens, if you could proceed with your presentation.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you're going to watch this very carefully, but I thought it's always appropriate to start with the Constitution, and I'm sure you're all carrying your Constitution with you. On page 11, if I read briefly, it says, the legislature shall adjourn from regular session no later than 120 consecutive calendar days from the date it convenes, except that a regular session may be extended once for up to 10 consecutive calendar days. That's all the Constitution mentions about the length of the session, but it's important to realize that our founding fathers thought it important to make that explicit in the Constitution. As you know, there was a vote of the public several sessions ago through the initiative process, and as you remember, that changed our meeting dates from 120 days to 90 days, and that barely passed. It did pass, but it passed barely through the initiative process. You should know that many bills have been introduced in the legislature over the years, actually over 20 introduced over the past several years. Never has one of these bills, to reduce the days of the legislature, but never have one of these bills really passed the legislature. They've all been considered carefully. They've been thought about, but there have always been concerns over changing from 120 days. Could we get the job done in that time? Would the public be adequately heard? The reasons some legislators supported the 90 days, the 90-day bill initiative, I think, were sort of questionable to me. Some seem a little selfish, some seem a little self-serving, some were just, it was convenient for them to have a shorter session so they get back to their hometowns and run their hotels or spend more time in their retirement condominiums. The problem I see is that this does, going to 90 days, does give more power to the governor and to the administration, and it doesn't allow us to do the job that we were elected to do. In the end, I think it's just not working, Mr. Chairman. If you support this, changing back to 120 days, it could hurt you politically. People get very upset about this. I've gotten some really nasty emails saying that obviously I'm a crook, and the best thing we can do is not be in Juneau at all. The less we do, the less we pass, the better off the state of Alaska is. But that's not our job. That's not why we were elected. We're here to do the right thing, do the right thing for our public, even if it's not convenient for us. Many of our colleagues, as I've talked to them about this 90-day issue, have expressed real concerns. Many of them like 90 days. They want to be home. They want to be with their families. They don't want to worry about their empty house. They want to spend more time attending to their business. If they're retired, maybe they, like I am, they want to spend more time in retirement, more golf, more whatever. But many have added, even though they like the time home, they're not able to do the job here properly and adequately. There's not enough time in session. So even though many people, many legislators, many senators like 90 days, they're not sure it's best for the state. They're not sure it's best for our constituents. Now, the governor opposes this. He's on record in the news as opposing this. I think every governor in Alaska would always support shorter legislative sessions. They want us out of town. We ask questions. We don't have to have the answers, but we can ask questions. We keep the administration's feet to the fire. Just look at a few days ago when you had the hearing on prisons. You asked a lot of impertinent questions about what was going on. So I think many past governors would say they don't like 120 days. They don't like 90 days. They don't like 30 days. Maybe three would be good. One day to travel, one day to vote for the governor's budget, and third day to get the heck out of town. Now, we represent the people. I can honestly say nobody in this legislature knows as much about Kodiak as I do and Representative Osterman. We have lived there for many years. I've lived in the same home in Kodiak for over almost 40 years now, and I know Kodiak. I've lived in villages for two winters. I know what life is like in my community. I listen to those voices, and the input of legislators, all of us around this table, is very important. A lot of details that I will ask Tim Lampkin to go into that we've uncovered as we've looked at this and looked at the original piece of legislation, the initiative that passed. It passed because people were concerned about the cost of the legislature. They were concerned about the number of people running for the legislature. Tim will show you an interesting slide that shows that in the year 2000, there were 150 people running for the legislature. One of the reasons this initiative passed was they wanted more people to run for the legislature, and that makes sense, get more people running, because you're spending less time here. Maybe then you could afford to actually be in Juneau as the legislator. Truth of the matter is, in 2010, there were only 100 people running for the legislature. So we went from 150 in 2000 to 100 in 2010. It didn't work. Shortening the legislative session did not work in getting more people to run for the legislature. So many of the reasons I believe this was on the ballot simply have not held up. What's the right answer? Quite honestly, I introduced the bill to have a discussion. Anything you do is okay with me. 100 days, 120 days the first session, 90 days the second, 90 days the first session, 120 the second. The important thing is that we have this discussion. The discussion about what is our job? How do we best do it? Does 90 days shortchange the public? I've received little advice from former Senate presidents, but one I did receive recently was, I think, really valid. The former Senate president said to me, leave the legislature in as good a shape as you found it, not in a weakened condition. And we have done that. We have left the legislature in a weakened condition. It's not our fault. The initiative did that. But the legislature is in a weakened condition compared to the administration and the governor. So in conclusion, I'd like to say, Mr. Chairman, it's not working. Look at the Constitution. Read the Constitution. It's such an important document. Tim Lampkin will go into more details. I have the privilege of being a little more esoteric here. But part of our job, I think, is to protect the institution we serve, the long history, and the enormous number of traditions of this legislature. And I think we've done some damage to it. This is our opportunity, I think, to right that wrong. And I'd like to introduce Tim Lampkin to go into more specific detail, Mr. Chairman, unless you have any questions.
Do committee members have questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, Mr. President, I guess as you look at the raw numbers that are there, I'd like your input on those, and maybe you can maybe be Mr. Lampkin's position to go ahead and answer the question more directly. But as you look at, you brought up the number of candidates that are there. 2000, you said there was 150. In 2010, 10 years later, there was only 100. As you look at those years of transition, though, there have been a number of things that have come into play, whether it's ethics, whether it's campaign contribution reform, and those kind of things. If we didn't have a shorter session, which I think invites more people to go ahead, they're busy, and that's one of the reasons they don't want to go ahead and have or become candidates, because they have other things going on. If you have that, I guess my real question has to do with, if those numbers aren't directly related to the duration, but if you had that, would you think that less people, there would have been only 75 that would have run in 2010? How do you know that that's not the case, that actually shortening the session has increased or has decreased the amount or the slope of the number of candidates that are out there? Do you have any thoughts or ideas on that?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Olson. I was careful not to say that one thing caused the other. But when the initiative was considered, one of the selling points was that more people would run for the legislature if we had a shorter session. I don't know why exactly it worked out that way, but it did. And the proof is in the pudding. 150 people running in 2000, 100 running in 2010. I can't say that this is a direct result, but it didn't work. If the goal was to get more people to run with a shorter session, it didn't work. That's my only point, Senator Olson. I don't say that one thing caused the other, but the reality is just to look at the figures. And maybe there are other issues that enter into it. Certainly there were other issues. I'm not saying this is the only one. But if the goal was to increase participation by having a shorter session, it simply did not, in the end, work out.
Thank you, Mr. President. Or Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Senator Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Stevens, for your presentation. I wondered if, during your consideration of lengthening the session, that you considered whether there should be any, or there would be any beneficial impact to having more regularly scheduled meetings through the interim to carry on business in between.
Thank you, through the chair. Well, that certainly has been the result of it. As you know, as Senator McGuire remembers, that we had our resource committee the last 2 years do extensive traveling around the state. It was very good, but it was also very expensive. And when you bring legislators from all over the state to a place like we went to Fairbanks once, we went to Tanana. I mean, that was always very expensive. So I think if you get all the legislators together in one place, it's good to keep them there until you get the business done. And if you have a lot of, it means if you have only 90 days, it means you have a lot more traveling. You have committees moving around the state here, having hearings. But one of the problems is that the rest of us are not here, are not there. And if we meet, say, in Rampart, the problem is that there's only the committee is there, and the rest of the Senate doesn't have a chance to really hear what's going on, see what's going on, and participate. If we have meetings here, like you're hearing on prisons, there was enormous involvement in that. Only the committee was here, but everyone was paying attention. So I think there's a disadvantage if you have a shorter session in order to have people meeting all around the state. It's expensive, and I don't think it works quite as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then for those watching at home, could you clarify the difference between the election and the Constitution, the electorate vote?
Yes, very good. The Constitution says very clearly the legislature shall adjourn no later than 120 consecutive calendar days from the date it convenes. What the initiative process did, which did pass, or barely passed, it changed that to 90 days. So we've been functioning under those 90 days for the last several sessions.
But as a matter of course, last session, the legislature did go beyond the 90 days, and I think there was an opinion that said that we did not break the law because the Constitution allowed us to do so. Isn't that correct, Mr. President?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's absolutely right. We did go over, I think, a half an hour. It was just a matter of moving material between us and the other body, and it did take us over a half an hour. But the attorneys have said very clearly that anything we passed within that 120 days is still legal and still follows the law and is the law. So you're absolutely right that we can go up to 120 days if we choose to. Some people have said, why don't you just leave it open and just go on until you finally get to a conclusion, as long as within 120 days. But the problem with that is that you really need to have an organized time, and whether it's 90 days or 100 days or 110 or whatever it might be, in order to structure the legislative session, you really need to have a conclusion, even though, as Senator Hoffman has made it clear, you can go over as long as you don't exceed the 121 days, which is really what the Supreme Court has decided.
Any other preliminary questions? Thank you, Senator Stephen. I think we're going to turn it over to your staff support to walk through the presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. With your indulgence, I'd like to go into this presentation and elaborate on many of the points that Senator Stevens has just made. First of all, of course, we all are here and understand that this bill essentially strikes a compromise from the vote that took place in 2006. It would expand every other session, the second session of each legislature, to 120 days. In 2006, ballot measure 1 was passed narrowly, shortened the session to 90 days. It passed by a margin of 50.8% to 49.2% in favor, in what was notably a very low voter turnout. You'll see here in this graph that these are a chart of our voter turnouts from 1976 to 2010. I'll point out that the spikes are presidential elections, whereas the valleys are state or muni elections. I'll point out to you that this right here is 2010, and it's the third lowest turnout since in that time span. So, incidentally, it was interesting to note that it passed by 3,843 votes. Statewide, there were 2,038,307 total cards cast for voters statewide. There were, however, 231,507 total cards cast for ballot measure 1, and therefore there were exactly 6,800 people who took a ballot but did not actually vote on ballot measure 1. Now, for what that's worth, it's just an interesting fact. I would like to opine that what were those people thinking, that they bothered to go to the ballot box and sign their name and check out a ballot but choose not to vote on this issue? And I would like to theorize, at least, that those folks perhaps felt that this is really an in-house decision, that it's a decision that should be made by the folks that are under the work burden. Nonetheless, a vote is a vote, and it did pass, so we've tried it. And this is the fourth year, the fourth session that the legislature has worked under this 90-day limit. However, as Senator Stevens has introduced this bill, we feel that it's not in the best interest that we operate this way, nor especially, and as I'm going to point out, are the arguments made to convince the public to pass this ballot measure being proven valid. Those arguments are, number one, and most substantially, the notion of reducing the cost of government, the fact at the time that 27 other states had shorter sessions than Alaska. Thirdly, that legislation had been introduced 24 times since 1990 on this particular subject, including, by the way, Governor Sean Parnell, since 1990, where no action had been taken. The bills had been killed in committee. And then finally, of course, the idea that at least theoretically, that less time in Juneau is less time away from home, away from your family, away from private sector work and other activities, and therefore would theoretically incentivize people, more qualified individuals, to run for office. So number one, specifically, right from the election pamphlet, it was stated that we will save 30 days of per diem and expenses of the operation of the legislature, paper, travel, copy costs, chaplain fees, lounge expenses, so on and so forth. However, if you look at our actual budget, since that time, our budget has continued to actually increase, our bottom line. Session legislative salaries have changed, of course. There is no longer long-term per diem, but session per diem and travel expenses still accrue throughout the year. Many of them accrue throughout the year, regardless of whether or not we're in session. So following the first 90-day session, incidentally, too, there were two 30-day special sessions in 2008. Those are not cheap, and since then we've pretty much replaced the way we allocate our monies from session expenses to interim expenses. The bottom line is still pretty much the same. Now, this is a chart that would help illustrate the frequency of interim activity from 2000-2010. I'll note that the peaks there are non-election years. The valleys are when we were undergoing an election cycle. I would note that in 2008, 9, and 10, there were significant increases in the interim activities, particularly those occurring in Anchorage. This is a chart that would demonstrate the actual number of days in session since statehood. Many folks feel that or believe that the 120-day session occurred from statehood, when in fact, when we did become a state in 19, 59, we had no limit constitutionally on our legislative sessions. They averaged, as you'll see there on the chart, around 75 days. In the 70s, there, when the pipeline days started kicking up, we had significant spikes in our legislative activity. The public recognized that that was an unacceptable trend, and in 1982, the legislature proposed a ballot referendum to advise the legislature on basically the question, should we limit our legislative sessions? During that 1982 vote, the public voted overwhelmingly in favor of yes, you should limit yourselves, and it was 1984 when the constitutional amendment was passed by ballot process. So then from 84 to 2006, you'll see we bumped around 120 days, and then here after the here we are at 90-day sessions. On the bottom, I've noted special sessions, and I've kept the line connecting the dots there when we've had back-to-back special sessions. And so you'll see subsequent to the shorter session, we had significant increases in our special sessions. Now, at this point, Mr. Chairman, I suppose if you would indulge me, I'd appreciate it if you took your bifocals off, because this is the fiscal note. We've received a little bit of flack over our initial fiscal note where it reflected a zero cost zero new appropriation. The point here being that this was a decision made amongst leadership that the money is there. It's been built into the base budget in response to the anticipated increase in interim activities, particularly special sessions and moving committee hearings. Basically, the money that was expected to be saved was put aside. It's still in the budget. The fiscal note doesn't say that it's not going to cost anything. It simply is saying that it's being absorbed, it's been built into our base, and that no new appropriation henceforth should expectedly be necessary. That point, of course, is arguable.
But before you go on, Mr. Committee, the fiscal notes have been restated. They're in your packet to reflect the ongoing cost of implementation. Even though some of these funds are already built in, there is a budgetary impact. So, anyway, just have your heads up. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Point here being that the savings, the roughly in the neighborhood of $800,000, represents approximately 2% of the legislature's total operating budget. If you put that in the context of the state's budget, the roughly $50 million that we spend now in the people's branch of government is, frankly, a drop in the bucket compared to the budget that we're watchdogging, the $10 billion spent by the executive branch. And so it seems to be an investment in accountability and watchdogging the executive branch, essentially. So our point is that, you know, there's really not a significant, if any, cost savings, a real reduction in the cost of government by maintaining a 90-day legislative session. Point number two is, what about all these other states that are limiting the duration of their legislative sessions? There's 27 of them. It's very, very common, as you know, when we introduce bills, very common for us to look at what other states are doing and to embrace those policies or to reject them summarily, depending on what side of an issue you particularly happen to fall on. And as part of the literature that was passed out to the people when the folks that were personally motivated to go around and get this initiative passed, they produced a pamphlet such as this. This is actually the very pamphlet, you might recognize it, pointing out that all of these other states have much, much shorter sessions than we do. And so it was kind of shock and awe to help get people to sign the petition and to vote in favor of shortening the session. Well, looking into it a little bit closer, I come to realize, well, let me back up here a moment. There's several different methods that, as we researched other states, the vast majority of them, of course, as you'll see there, are limited by their constitution. A handful, including Alaska, and Alaska should actually be listed under both constitution and statutorily, have limits. Those three have chamber rules, which is to say, at the very beginning of session, before they actually convene, they get together, the leadership gets together, and they write a resolution, and they decide amongst the leadership that we shall adjourn on this date. The indirect method is very interesting and probably would be popular among the public. And those states choose after day X, say day 90 or 100, in those states, they are statutorily no longer eligible to receive per diem, which seems to be an interesting motivator to have those respective legislatures wrap up their business in a more timely manner. It's a different discussion. Then, of course, 11 states have no limit, which, of course, is not to say that they don't that they meet year-round. It's just that they don't have a limit imposed on them. But looking at the literature and pointing out that all these other states have shorter sessions than we do, it was interesting to find out, looking at it closer, that there's a distinction between legislative calendar days and actual legislative days. The difference there being, of course, an example here in Alaska, the Senate convenes Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Those would be counted as legislative days in a 7-calendar-day period. We operate under a 90-calendar-day system at the moment. When they passed out this pamphlet, it was pointed out that, for example, I picked out just a few. Alabama is noted there as having 30, in odd and even years, 30 days versus 105 legislative days. In fact, I went back to 2002 and all 50 states and averaged the total number of actual calendar days from the time that they convene in session in the Capitol to the time that they adjourn that session or adjourn sine die that same calendar year. On average, the last 8 years, Alabama's in fact had 102 days. It gets worse. Hawaii, where it says there that they've only supposedly have 60 legislative days, in fact has 106 calendar days. Now, during those non-legislative days, of course, is what we're talking about is committee hearings, when we meet like today, when we don't have session, but we're still active, we're still doing the people's work, but it's not technically a legislative day. The third example, where Indiana says 90 and 30 days, excuse me, it says 60 and 30 on odd and even years, when in fact Indiana has 130 average calendar days every year. The worst example, and I won't go through them all, but was in Tennessee where they compared us. Tennessee only has 90 legislative days. They have, in fact, 146 calendar days on average from 2002 to the current. Here is a graph that compares us to all the other states that just looks at that same chart and line stacks everyone up. We are right in the middle, pretty much. We've shifted a little bit to the right since we've gone to 90 days. As we go further into the future, we will continue to shift further to the right until we settle on a close to the 90-day mark. So, you know, of course, every state is different. Every state has its own unique set of reasons for choosing to operate the legislature the way it does. And similarly, Alaska can be known as sort of a do-it-yourself state. So in this case, we'd like to say, who cares what other states are doing? We're in the middle of the road in this issue, and Senate Bill 18 essentially moves us even closer to that Senate. Point number three is that legislation had been introduced 24 times since 1990 in an effort to shorten the session, and each attempt had failed. Well, we all know that legislation that has virtually no or very little likelihood of passing legislature is introduced almost every day. The legislature, you have the prerogative to act or not act on any issue, and I assure you there are certainly more issues than there are ever going to be actions, no offense. This is a graph that would indicate, for what this is worth, just the data from 1979 to the last legislature, the number of bills introduced and the number of bills passed. This is a chart that would stack us up against all the other states. Many people would like to, of course, compare the legislature, the way that it functions, measure its success by the amount of bills it passes, which I think you might agree that that's really not a fair way to measure us. I'd like to borrow a metaphor from a member of the other house that I picked up on, that the legislature doesn't really act like a widget factory. It's not like we are constantly in factory line manufacturing bills. It's more like a rocket launch where there's lots of work behind the scenes that builds up and culminates into a final burst at the end like we typically do. Here is the average pieces, average pieces passed by legislatures. Here's the ratio, which interestingly, we are right in the middle of ratio of bills introduced to those passed. But again, all the time, issues are presented that don't pass. A real contentious one is the issue of abortion, which I looked up and has been introduced 55 times since 1990. With no substantive action. Another favorite perennial is move the Capitol, 28 times since 1990. I didn't count these, but oil and gas taxation, subsistence, coastal zone management, truancy, compulsory school age, mine taxes, so on and so forth. Point being that there are it's difficult, or the reasoning of the argument made by the supporters pushing for ballot measure one, that should any bill that fails to pass the legislature after X number of attempts should automatically be forwarded to the ballot box for a vote. Now, that's a rhetorical question, of course, but we would argue that's not a valid argument to say something just because it has been attempted so many times, because something should not become law simply because the legislature has consistently chosen not to make it a law on its own. And then finally, point number four, the notion that shorter sessions means less time away from home, away from family, away from private sector work, and so on and so forth, things that we might all rather be doing, and therefore would incentivize more competition, as the Juneau Empire, I think, wrote, between quality individuals. Well, this chart speaks for itself. Senator Olson asked this question earlier. This is not to say that one causes the other effect, but the fact is that since the 2006, and particularly in the 2008-2010 election, was a nosedive in the number of candidates in the primary elections. So since 2006, the candidate pool has shrunken by 20%, which is the exact opposite of what the folks that were favoring the initiative process were arguing. Now, there's a couple other things to consider, of course, here. Public testimony in the deliberative process. I think we all recognize that it's much more difficult for legislators to visit with their constituents when they come to town. I could go on about that. I'd be remiss if I didn't throw a pitch out to my fellow staff members that it's a fact that our workloads have increased substantially. I know that we even now are working 10 or 12 hour days, which, mind you, for the record, is not a complaint by any means, but it is a fact that it's essentially free overtime. There was a House survey in 2009, a subcommittee of Legislative Council, that came out that supported overwhelmingly restoring a 120-day session. And, of course, perhaps most significantly is the notion of the balance of power. And that was, in college, my favorite area was in political theory. This is essentially a balance of power issue, bottom line. The ability to meet annually with less constraint on duration in order to keep abreast of current issues, federal or state developments, review the programs that have been passed and been funded, administrative activity and oversight. It's all generally considered necessary for the legislature to be an effective policy-making body, and especially to not to avoid being dominated by the executive branch. Considering the balance of power and a shorter legislative session buoyed by personal motivations to keep it shorter does not do the issues before us, nor the people being represented, quite enough justice. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I conclude my presentation. Thank you very much for your
time. Do you have any questions on the presentation? We've got, as mentioned in the presentation, there's two fiscal notes in your packet from the Legislative Affairs Agency. And the first fiscal note reflects $450,000 increase in session expenses every other year. The second note reflects $413,000 increases in salaries and allowances every other year. And for those watching at home, the legislature, a lot of times legislative employees, staff, get reduced in the off session quite a bit. So there's part of that number. But that will give you an idea of the financial impacts. It's hard for us to put a number on the financial impacts that the state faces from lack of time dealing with issues such as that we had last week that was mentioned, dealing with the a prison situation where we have substantial impacts on our budget and things like that. But that would be numbers that are very difficult to put an analysis on when the legislature doesn't have the time to do its oversight duties. If we don't have any questions on that, we're going to...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Senator Olson.
Excuse me, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the fiscal note, Mr. Lamkin, one of the earlier comments was that this bill would not go into effect until 2014. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the effective date on the bill is January 1st, 2012. It would be next session.
Okay, so it would be a year from now we start a 120-day session, not 2014.
In the odd, the even years, we would have a 120-day session, and therefore, I believe it would be effective in FY12.
There is some monies already in the system, and the fiscal note looks forward into a budgetary impact of the coming years. That's why there's a confusion on the, on the fiscal notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any other questions? We've got nobody's called in online, and I have no sign-up sheet delivered to me for anybody in the audience that wants to come forward and testify. Is that correct? Seeing none, we'll come back to the committee. Do we have any other final questions for the bill sponsor before we before we ask for final comments? I'd just like to make a brief one of the most important roles the legislature has, and that is the power of appropriations and the power of oversight. And the time element it takes to deal with the operating budget, capital budget, and the mental health budget consumes probably well over a third, if not half, of our time. Clearly now, in the last month of session, that's going to be the driving issue that consumes virtually all of our time, and it makes it difficult to move forward with the normal policy issues in front of us, and much less, or even to a greater extent, makes it more difficult to deal with any major policy issues that we have, one of which, as an example, is the oil taxation bill that's in the building right now today. But that's not the only issue within the building. So it makes it very difficult from a time constraint time frame to adequately do our job. And as Senator Stevens had mentioned in his presentation, some folks would be happy if we were only in session 3 days a week, 3 days a year. You know, one day to arrive, one to pass the budgets, and two to leave. But we are the source of public involvement within the management of the state. Without the legislature, that only leaves the administration headed by one individual. So even though a lot of people grumble at the legislature, we are their avenue to run the democracy. Senator Stevens, do you have any final comments before we set your bill aside?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I simply introduced the legislation so we could have the discussion. I think it's a very important discussion. I don't know that I really believe there is a right answer out of this, and whatever amendments were to happen, I would not be upset about that. I think just spending the time trying to discuss, trying to figure out what the right answer is, I think that's the right thing to do, and I appreciate your considering this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and set that bill aside. Next up, Senate Bill 19 by Senator French regarding the passenger vehicle rental tax. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today, we have Senator French. If you could come forward, please. You can introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and present the bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. My name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate. I have with me Andy Motoro, the staffer in my office assigned to this bill. Senate Bill 19, the passenger vehicle rental tax, is really aimed at some very small entrepreneurial individuals in Alaska who have found themselves caught up in a passenger vehicle rental tax that I do not believe was ever aimed at them. These individuals rent motorcycles. They rent them in the summertime. They have a very short season. They have a very high carrying costs. They have to keep these fleets year-round. And when we put this passenger vehicle rental tax on the books many, many years ago, indeed, probably for 4 or 5 years, the tax was never collected as against these people. I think they'll make good presentations on their own about how they've been impacted by this tax and so forth. motorcycle rentals really bring independent travelers to Alaska. They're not cruise ship folks. They're not the typical traveler. They're independents who travel to the far reaches of the state, bringing their checkbooks, bringing their digital cameras, and bringing their memories back to the people they see when they go home. And sort of bringing Alaska to the lower 48 through their adventures, and bringing their businesses to parts of the state that don't get visited very often by what we think of as the structured tourism industry. The bill really simply eliminates the passenger vehicle rental tax as to these operators who rent motorcycles during the short season of the summertime. And I think it's well-intentioned. It has a very small impact to the state treasury that I know you keep a sharp eye on, Mr. Chairman. And really, that's the basis of the bill. I've got staff here to answer technical questions, folks who can tell you more about the impact on their business. But I really just want to thank you for hearing the bill and for taking up this idea.
Do you have any initial questions for have your staff introduce themselves, please?
Thank you, Chair Stedman. For the record, Andy Motoro, staff to Senator French.
I'd like to welcome you to Senate Finance. I think this is your first visit here.
Yep, this session.
Presenting a bill.
Yes.
No matter what you've heard about Senate Finance, we are a friendly lot.
I've always believed that.
Always working hard to move the state forward in a physically prudent manner. So, okay, we have, seems like we have no initial questions from the committee members. We have one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue. Passage of this legislation would result in a $12,000 reduction in state revenue. And we have seen no questions initially on the fiscal note. We will move to the online, and we have no one signed up come in online, and we have, excuse me, we do have in the off-net, excuse me, in the off-net we have two for testimony. Well, what I'd like you to do is introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then speak to the bill in front of us, Senate Bill 19, and we'll start with Nancy Hall, please.
Hello, my name is Nancy Hall. Can you hear me?
Not very well. If you could speak up a little bit, please.
Yes, my name is Nancy Hall, H-U-L-L. I'm the owner of Alaska Motorcycle Adventures. We're located out of Palmer, Alaska. We have been renting motorcycles in Alaska for 18 years. We started in 1994 with two motorcycles. We have been successful. This summer will be our 18th year. I'm asking for the passing of the Senate Bill 19. As you just heard, a 90-day session or a 90-day season like we have is very short. It's hard to make it in that period of time. And I would just hope that you could eliminate the vehicle rental tax. Our customers come from all over the globe. Most of them have a bucket list of places that they would like to ride on the planet, Alaska being just one of them. It's easy for them to eliminate Alaska based on the high cost structure, the taxes, and go to one of their other places that they would like to ride. So it does bring a lot of independent tourism, as Senator French had mentioned. When we have fewer rental days or the people do not rent in Alaska, we need fewer employees. We put less dollars into our local business in the winter, and we basically drink fewer lattes. I did collect the tax in 2010. I think there's been some confusion that some of the rental companies have and have not collected the tax. The one and only year that I did collect it was 2010. I wanted to give you some examples of the rental tax that we collect so you can make some comparisons to the other tourism sectors. Our rentals go for approximately $150 to $200 or $240 per day. So let's just take an average day of $200 per day. On a 7-day rental, that's $20 a day. and that's $140 for that 1 week of rental. The same rental of a motor home would be $6 per day, or $42 for the same 7 days. A cruise passenger on a 7 day cruise would pay $34.50 for that 7 days. As you can see, the $34.50 versus the $140 of tax is basically four times the amount for that same amount of time in visiting Alaska, yet our renters and riders are in the remote areas of Alaska like Wiseman, Chicken. They visit Gracious House on the Denali Highway. They're in Eagle. They're in McCarthy. They like those remote locations. When I set them up on an itinerary, I pick the local fare for them to stay in bed and breakfast, to eat in the local restaurants, and to book their tours with the local vendors. I would hope that you would support this bill, and I thank you for hearing me today. And if you have any questions, I would be glad to answer those.
Okay, thank you for your testimony today. Next up, Philip Freeman, please.
Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. My name is Philip Freeman. I'm with MotoQuest. I'm born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska, and started this business 12 years ago. We have grown. We have a fleet of 40 motorcycles, and I employ up to 10 people in the summer. The tax is very difficult for us, and I think Nancy and Senator French explained some of the nuances for you. I don't need to repeat, but it's a really fun business, but we're not making much for a profit, and the 10% tax is a killer, specifically because we are renting motorcycles in the shortest season in the world. So it's very hard for us to eat on a bucket list with other destinations. I guess that's all I really have to say. I really appreciate you for taking time to review this.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. That concludes call-ins on the off-net. I've got no one signed up in the room, but we do have Joanna Bales from the Department of Revenue online. Are you still online, Ms. Bales?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Could you help the committee with the comments made during the testimony that some of these taxes were not paid to the state, collected? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It did come to our attention probably about, I would guess, 4 or 5 years after the vehicle rental tax came into effect, that we did have these businesses that were renting, and we had not collected, we did not recap those businesses, which we have done since then, and we've taken a look at the statutes, and under the statutes, they do meet the definition of passenger vehicle. So they are subject, and we are trying to work with companies to bring them in. It might be no, just to note, the Mississippi Anchorage specifically exempts motorcycles from their vehicles.
Ms. Bales, could you... Are you on a cell phone by chance?
No, I'm not.
You're breaking up. So could you give us a little bit of history on why the tax wasn't collected, when it started to be collected, and what's the plan going forward?
As I stated, we weren't aware that these companies actually were renting motorcycles. And once we discovered that, probably about 2 years ago, we did contact them, and we are working to bring them into compliance.
Okay. Can you give us any more information than that? What amounts of or number of potential businesses are we dealing with? Or, I mean, the answer is pretty vague.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we think that there are approximately five companies.
Ms. Bale, I think what we'll do, because we're going to be holding this bill over anyway, maybe you're on a speakerphone or something. We'll have the department get back to the committee in writing the history of this situation and what policies were taken by the department to rectify it and where the department stands today going forward, because it's just the connection is too difficult for us to continue with the call-in. Thank you, Ms. Bales.
Okay.
That concludes our list today. And do we have any final in the audience? See, they want to come forward and speak to this. Is there any final questions, comments by the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator French, as you look at the amount of money that's there, I'm not sure how much there is, and not the point. I guess my question has to do with, if you go from a 10% tax rate, which I understand is, by Ms. Hall, it was fairly significant to their viability as a business, and to eliminating, that's kind of a large jump there. Would you be opposed to an amendment that would decrease it down to the amount that would be a little more friendly toward the revenues of the state? Because obviously there's more wear and tear on there. There's obviously ambulance calls that come out with vehicle accidents and those kind of things. And then that's just the tip of the iceberg. How opposed to an amendment on this bill would you be?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, obviously the bill's in your hands, and I'd be happy to work with you or any other member of the committee to see what's right. The thing I would keep in mind is, as you lower the amount of tax, you're going to get to a point of what I would call diminishing returns. You've already got a fairly insignificant amount of money that you're taking in from this tax to begin with. If you cut it in half or a third, it'll even be less, and at some point I think the carrying costs of collecting it become more than what you actually get in the state treasury. So I appreciate the thought. I think it's something I've had, because when you compare, for example, with RVs only pay 3%, and so that's sort of a target number that you might consider using 3%, but at that rate, you're collecting just a few thousand dollars a year.
Good point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Senator French? Senator French, can you help us a little bit maybe with the question that was asked of the department? And just as far as your knowledge on the subject matter, on the lack of collection, how many participants are out there that should be paying, how many are paying? I know nobody wants to pay any taxes, so we understand that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, looking through the emails that have gone back and forth over the years and some dialogue between the Department of Revenue and the business owners, I think it was simply a matter of oversight. I don't think these motorcycle folks thought of themselves as being in the passenger vehicle rental operation. When the original bill went through the legislature, you know, I've read through the minutes, it was all about, you know, Avis and RVs and, you know, cars. These are small businesses. They're almost boutique businesses. They just operate for a few months, and I really do think they escaped the notice of the Department of Revenue. In fact, there's an email in here that says basically one day a Department of Revenue person was driving down Spinard Road in my district, sees the House of Harley, and next to the House of Harley is a small motorcycle rental operation, and that revenue person goes, oh my goodness, they rent vehicles, they should be paying the tax. And so it was really by chance that they ever even came to the attention of the state, or we may not even be here today.
Okay. We have any other questions for Senator French? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I notice in the definitions that obviously motorcycle is not there, but almost every other thing that you can travel on is there, so it does appear it was an oversight. And we did have questions regarding the amount of money, and obviously there's very little money on the fiscal note because the tax wasn't collected, so therefore we wouldn't really know. So the question is appropriate, what would it have been? But realistically, I can't imagine the oversight of not putting a motorcycle somewhere. We have watercraft, mobile homes, and almost everything else. Is that your understanding, too, that it was simply an oversight and people did not see the word motorcycle anyplace in the law and it just kind of slipped by?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, you know, that's as good an explanation as any, although just for the committee's understanding, what you're seeing here is a list of exceptions to what a passenger vehicle is. And so a passenger vehicle means a motor vehicle and does not include a commercial motor vehicle, an emergency fire equipment, farm vehicle, et cetera. Those are all the exceptions to what a passenger vehicle is. Since a motorcycle was not listed as an exception, of course, it is by definition a passenger vehicle. But again, I just don't think that's something that came to the mind of the folks who passed the bill in the first place and were thinking about this. You know, is a motorcycle really a passenger vehicle? Well, unless you accept it, it is. But I think it was a legitimate oversight for many years, both from the Department of Revenue and the business owners, that they just weren't caught up in this bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any final comments from Senator French before we set this bill aside for further review?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you for coming today and breaking in your new staff member. We will see him back again in front of the committee on several other issues.
Absolutely.
That concludes the meeting today. Tomorrow, there is no meeting. We'll continue to work on our issues at the committee, at the staff level, and amongst ourselves as we move forward. Next meeting is Thursday, March 10th, 9 a.m. We're going to have two bills on the agenda, Senate Bill 34, the Small Business Revolving Loan Fund, followed by Senate Bill 58, increasing the number of Superior Court judges. Unless we have any further comments or concerns, seeing none, we are adjourned.